Thomas B. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
The civil rights. Kind of a loaded question in our day and age because of the attachment of meaning to the words and the phrases civil rights. I will try to define it in a little bit. But you know, it's awfully easy if you've never been in a real minority situation. There's a sense in which all Bible believers are. But if you've never been in a real minority situation, it's awfully easy to imagine that everybody's rights are the same and everybody has a fair shake at all times. It's awfully easy to imagine that if you've never been in a minority situation. If at some time you've been the umpire of a softball team that made an unpopular call in a town of the rival team and thereby have found yourself in a truly minority situation, with everybody shouting at you, many people saying, kill him, others saying, where are your glasses, a few others threatening, and if you've ever had to leave rapidly, then you must know intrinsically something of the value of civil rights, that every civil person has certain rights in any kind of a commonwealth and society. The danger is that if you've never been in minority status at all, that is, in an appreciable minority status at all, if you've never been there, then you don't realize how an unthinking majority easily acts. Not always with malice, but it easily acts that way. That's just simply the way it goes. And so there are six of us Welshmen sitting in a room eating lunch together. My father was a Welshman. I'm kind of hybridized because mother's family was not so particular. But there are six of us, a lot of Welshmen sitting in a room eating together. You know, they all sing with great loud voices. You've come in the room with your lunch, you're going to sit there and you're going to read Packer, The Knowledge of God, or something like that. And so the six Welshmen decide to hold a song fest at the same time. And while you're trying to read your book, the air is filled with loud and strenuous singing, rollicking laughter, people slapping the table. You look around and say, I'd like to read my book. And one of them says, if you'd like to read your book, go someplace where other people are reading books. Not really with malice, but because a majority is easily unthinking. It's the way it can be in a local church when 70% of the people decide that they'd like Sunday school to start at 5 o'clock in the morning. So that they'll have time to garden when it's over, see? 5 o'clock in the morning, 70%. You say, what about the rest of us, the 30%? The majority say, well, if you don't like it, start another church but a golf course. See, that you think those things don't happen, but they do happen. And that's where the matter of civil rights comes up in a very big way, both within the church and within the culture. When certain aspects of a population feel that they are disenfranchised, whether they really are or not becomes a matter of study. But when they feel that they are disenfranchised within their culture, they quickly begin calling for their rights. And sometimes theologians have stood back and said, well, if you got your rights, you'd be sent to hell right away. They are talking about a different kind of right. The rights that we identify with civil rights are the rights to breathe and to live and to express yourself within the culture on an equality with just about everybody else. And all of us are interested in those rights for ourselves. What we have to be careful with is that we are interested in them for others also. Now, what we've done in the seminar so far is to discuss rather broadly the sanctity of life, how life was created by God. Men are created, men and women, in His likeness and His image, created for His honor and for His glory. Now, we've talked a little bit about homicide and the things that relate to it, and some of the things that relate in public practice, emphasizing that man is a special creation. God made him for Himself, made him to honor Him, and that those things in life which are contrary to what honors God are not good things. We've stressed that several times. Different men have stressed it in different ways. But that which does not honor God in your life is not good for you. And consequently, when we come down to the whole societal relationship, that still is kind of true. What is not in a proper sense honoring of God is certainly not good for us. Now, when we come to this particular discussion, I'm not, as I mentioned on my notes, talking about the current social problems. I may say a few words about them as we go. I'm aware of some of them, at least, but that isn't particularly what we're doing. There are other times for a critique of society. What we are trying to do in this discussion is see what rights civilians have under a broad-based biblical concept. recognizing, as I mentioned somewhere in these notes, that we do not live in the theocracy, recognizing that we do not have a perfect Christian community, recognizing that the kingdom is not yet here in the physical entity. If you happen to think that it is, the proof of your thinking will be whether you lock your car with your CB radio in it when you park it in Center City. But I say that humorously. That's not very scholarly. When you don't have enough facts to be scholarly, then you'd be funny. If you're funny enough, you can make up for what you don't know. You kind of have to remember that. And, of course, we usually say in homiletics, if you can't be funny, then be loud. That's why people raise their voices when they argue. A man who is sure of himself talks more softly as he argues. He doesn't have to deafen you. However, that's free advice. So you cover a lot of ground in this particular course. Cover a lot of ground. So the thing that I'm trying to emphasize is in talking about the sanctity of life in the matter of civil rights, what we're looking at and saying is life is created by God, it's special, we're for His honor and glory. Now what rights are ours as civilians, not only for ourselves, but to be shared and guarded with others in a culture, which even though is not Christian, may yet see the divine ideals from the Word of God, may yet see the divine principles that will be here when the kingdom is here in its physical manifestation. We can see those things. Now, out of what we can see from what God has done and what He's going to do, what are the rights that ought to pertain in the culture in which we find ourselves? And that becomes our particular point. If somebody says, well, we're not living in Israel, we don't stone the blasphemous child anymore, we don't do this, that, and other things, that's right. But we are interested in the ideals behind those things. Now, which ideals seem to be true of the character and omniscience and wisdom of God and the best possible interpretation of those ideals in our culture and frame of reference. So you come into what I refer to as the cultural problem. The great difference that often exists between the biblical ideal and cultural pragmatism. Cultural pragmatism meaning the thing that works for a particular culture. The biblical ideal is to love one another as I have loved you. But cultural pragmatism often puts a whole section of people that you hardly like at all, let alone love. And for those who say, well, we love them, we just don't like them, there are some validities to that if you play with the Greek words, but most people who say it can hardly pronounce the Greek words, let alone play with it. They're just looking for a kind of a quick cop-out on a particular ideology. So the biblical ideal is often one thing. The cultural pragmatism is sometimes very different. And that's where we get into real problems, see. The biblical ideal is to see every man, I think, as God sees him, not to be a judger or respecter of faces. But yet in cultural pragmatism, when a new class sets in front of me, I will immediately see a few students. I'm a little weaker than other teachers maybe, but I will immediately see a few students. And in my mind, before I know who he is, I'll immediately say, there's somebody that I'll like. Just it's an automatic reaction. And every now and then I'll see somebody and I'll say, there's somebody. He ought to take Dr. Newman's course this hour. Just every now and then. Now I find that the Lord helps us to overcome those things. But don't tell me that you never feel that way because I hate to meet hypocrites. I just hate to meet them. I don't like to be one either. You may be the person who doesn't. But 9 people out of 10 form judgments on others with regard to their agreeability in life long before they have opportunity to know them well. Takes you a long time to know somebody well. I always marvel at the church that gets its candidates and here's a fellow and, they've heard him 2 minutes and half of them dislike him violently and half of them think he's pretty fair and the other half, there's always 3 halves in these church things, the other half are waiting to see how the first half goes so they'll know what side to take. The biblical ideal is to respect others, no question about that. And yet you'll immediately find that it's a lot easier to judge disrespect in others than it is to bring it to ourselves. So that becomes the problem. So in culture, the biblical ideal is that everybody stands equally before the law of God. But in cultural pragmatism, the fellow who can bribe the judge is very likely to escape it. And in some cultures, the man who will bribe the judge the most, it's not just one man, they're both bribing him. In some cultures, the fellow with the biggest bribe is the chap who does it. I read a book this last Christmas that Dr. McCrae gave me entitled Tongue of the Prophets, study of a man who in the last century, in the early part of this century, succeeded in revising biblical Hebrew, a Hebrew man who lived in Palestine, and of the great difficulties he had getting permission to do those things. Eliezer ben Yehuda. The great difficulty. Almost every action required a bribe. Not because he was dishonest, but because his foes already had all the judges bribed to the teeth. And it got to be a matter that when he went before a judge, it was simply a matter of the judge saying, well, I've already been paid so many shekels for this decision. How much is your view worth? And one of the humorous notes came when he pointed out that on getting permission to reprint his Jewish newspaper, his Hebrew newspaper, that he received a large book from Baron von Rothschild, in which Baron had written him a letter saying this was to be a present to the governor of Syria. Would he please make a present of it personally to the governor of Syria from the Baron, a great book of fanciful European art. And it related how his emissaries took it to the Baron without really thinking much about it. I mean, from wondering what the governor of Syria would care for a great book of that particular sort. But when he opened the first page and saw that there was 10,000 francs between every page, he suddenly saw that the governor would be greatly impressed by the art in the book. And of course, when I read through a thing like that, I'm kind of appalled at it. But it was the culture and parlance of its time. And what it meant was that those who were wealthy and had power could have things their way. And poor peasants like most of you look to be just took it on the chin. We look out and say that in the biblical state there would be no disparity based on how much money you had, where you came from, or how you cut your hair. That in the biblical state, all dealings would be based on equity and equality and justice, the righteousness that marks the character of the Lord himself. But in cultural pragmatism, it often doesn't work that way. I'm not solving the cultural pragmatic problems today. I want to talk about the civil rights and then see them applied as they apply in our backgrounds. But that's all in the background of that thing. Now, when we come down to the concept of civil rights proper, I will try to define for you three aspects that I refer to as civil rights that are defined in the Scripture. The rights of citizens, the rights of civilians. When I was scratching in my office the other day, I wrote the rights of civil persons. But then I realized that civil persons, that might describe somebody that doesn't laugh very much. It's hard to tell what that might do. So the rights of citizens or the rights of civilians. Three areas of civil rights as they are defined in the concept of the ideals of the biblical pattern. The first of those is the right of law. The right of law. The right of all persons to be governed in equity with a common standard binding them in responsibility before God. That we call the right of law. Now, as I'll say in a couple of moments, there will be special laws for special groups. But even within that group, there will be an equality or an equity, if you will, of persons. For example, there will be a special law for the priests on what he's doing when he's working at the tabernacle. But there will be no priests who are exceptions to that particular law as a class. And there will be a special law for the prophet when he's giving a prediction, but no prophet will be an exception to that special concept. That's what I mean. There will be a special law for the pedestrian when he's walking, and a special law for the fellow who's driving his car. The signs that say 35 miles per hour do not relate to joggers necessarily. Although if you can do it, be sure to pass on the left in Pennsylvania if you can do it. But the sign that says use crosswalks only do not relate to cars. And you know, those are silly kind of things, but they're awfully important. In Augusta, Georgia years ago, I don't know how it is today because I haven't been there for a long time, but in Augusta, Georgia, they had the big crosswalks, and any time there was a pedestrian in the crosswalk, all the cars coming were to stop while that pedestrian crossed. And the great game in Augusta for servicemen from the military base who had been in the public houses a little too long was to stand on a curb until traffic was moving at its thickest and then walk out in the street and stop them in both directions, stand there and smile and beam. I was not one of those fellows. I was one of the guys that went and got him out of the street. But all cars were to stop. See, pedestrians didn't have to stop. All cars. So there was a special law for the cars. But all cars were equal under it, with the possible individual exceptions of a fire engine racing to put out a fire or an ambulance hurrying to get you to the hospital before your ticker stopped ticking or something like that. Those, as I'll mention later, are what we call personal exceptions, which apply under many kinds of law. So the civil right of law is the privilege of being governed in equity with a common standard. Equality under the law ought to be an understood civil right after the background of the biblical ideal. Now, that's been a big part of the problem in the movements in this country, whether you like to think of it or not, that it was hard to get equality under the law in some aspects of the culture. Awfully hard to get it. I'm not saying that it never happened, but it was awfully hard to get. Because between the prejudices infused by money, the prejudices infused by race, the prejudices infused by particular crimes, it was hard to gain equality under the law. I'm not at all, I'll just make a tangent here on local politics. I won't argue it either, I'll just tell you what it is. I'm not at all out of disharmony with the sentences recently given to two prominent Pennsylvania lawmakers for their problems in public life and their relation. I don't think the sentences run just, but if they are compared to the sentences given to some of the more nationally famous persons sentenced 4 and 5 years ago under the Watergate thing, then they're unjust. You know, I'm not sure that the same statutes apply to the two. I'm just saying that equality under the law is sometimes hard to establish. But if a man steals a dime and you sentence him to jail for 100 years, and another man steals $1 million, and because of his status you give him 5 months probation, that is hardly equality under the law. Now, it may be that the man who steals $500 once never did it before in his whole life, and the man who steals a dime has done it every day from a blind man by knocking him down. So there can be aggravated circumstances. There can be aggravated circumstances that certainly have to be looked into. But the thrust of it is that equality under the law ought to be one of the biblically understood civil rights. So you'll see a great example of it in the situation of Naboth's vineyard. When I'm not going to look at the account, but you'll see a great example of it there. When Ahab wanted the vineyard and in his baby-like way moaned because he couldn't have it, his wife found that by getting two witnesses to say that Naboth had blasphemed, he could be stoned, and then having no heirs, the property would be the king's. Very simple thing. And Dr. McRae used to say, why didn't the king just take it? He was king. He was all, why? Well, because there was still a sense of equality under the law. They had to somehow get rid of that fellow before his estate could be picked up and taken by another. It's a kind of a complicated thing, and there's more to it than that. But you know, if two witnesses spoke against you as a blasphemer, a death penalty could be executed. Well, one witness was not enough. And so Jezebel simply found a few people, it would say a couple guys, who could say that he blasphemed, somewhat the same situation with the Lord's trial. Equality under the law ought to be a commonly understood civil right. Now, I'm very pro-American. I hope you understand what I mean by that. I'm thankful to be here. I'm glad that my grandfather jumped the British Army in South Africa and fled the United States in 1890. That's what he did. In his memory, a sip of my coffee. That's almost what he did. It amounted about the same thing. And it took them 2 years to know where he was. They thought he was in the bush near Johannesburg, but he was in the bush near Pittsburgh. Well, whatever the case happens to be, equality under the law should be a commonly understood sort of thing. And whereas I'm very much an American citizen, very much pro, I think we have by far the most egalitarian government and principles anywhere in the world. I don't doubt it for a moment. Now, you certainly are not going to get the shake in Russia that you get here if you're called before a charge. You have to sit down and read Solzhenitsyn a few times and a few even fellows that are in favor of the system to get that particular picture. But if you think that equality of the law under it is automatic throughout the whole country, you simply are hopelessly naive. That's all. Just hopelessly naive. And you may come to understand it sometime when you're picked up in a speed trap near Schnuckelville and discover that court costs there are more than your whole car is worth. So they keep the car and arrest you the next day for hitchhiking. But equality under the law is by no means to be taken for granted. Now, in the framework of the biblical pattern, I mentioned some explicit concepts. In the framework of the biblical pattern, I mentioned some explicit concepts. Now, these apply to different things. You might do well to look at them. I mentioned Exodus 12:49. I use the word explicit and implicit in these notes in a highly arbitrary way. That means I use it however I want to. But by explicit, I mean those things that seem to be pretty emphatic and seem to be pretty clear. So in Exodus 12, at verse 49, with regard to the Passover, we were told how the children of Israel would keep it in verse 47. We're told that when a stranger would sojourn, his male should be circumcised, and he'd be like one born as the land if he's brought in that way in verse 48. But in verse 49 it says, one law shall be to him that is homeborn and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you. That does not mean the heathen 500 miles away. He doesn't celebrate the Passover. But when it comes to the Passover, there will be a common law, one law that will apply to you that are born here and to the sojourner who has come to dwell in your midst, to the person who's going to commemorate the particular thing with you. And no double standard, the concept of one law in the Passover setting. In Leviticus 24, most of these verses you'll know are from the notice from the Pentateuch. The broader concepts are found other places, but the specific wording in the Pentateuch is pretty important. In Leviticus 24, at verse 22, you shall have one manner of law, as well for the stranger as for one of your own country. And that is not the Passover, but that's the whole matter of community justice. The whole matter, see, of somebody who's killed your beast by the breach for breach, the whole matter of community justice. The law, I don't think, and this is somebody else's discussion probably, really meant that if somebody punched you in the mouth and knocked out a tooth, you had to stand up while he knocked out one of yours. I think the law of retribution is to make sure that justice and compensation and those things are involved in the heart of the people. And that's why if a slave was gored by an ox and died, you paid, that's one of there was a 30 shekel silver price upon him. And consequently, in the law of retribution, in the law of justice, there will be the same law for the stranger as for your own country. It's a good man who doesn't make exceptions for his own family. I've had two or three ministerial friends that thought divorce was the most... that's another subject, too. I'm just giving an illustration. They thought divorce was the most abominable, wretched, miserable, corrupt, degrading practice that the world had ever heard of until they had a sister who got divorced. And suddenly, they set up an office. Not really, but their whole theology changes when it becomes personal, see? As long as it's you, you're wrong, but when it's me, we better think twice. Now, that certainly is not right, and that's why the law says the stranger and the homeborn, one law for the same. You don't make an exception because it's your son who's stealing the offering, whereas if it's the deacon's son, you want his hands cut off. It's not that kind of a policy. One law for the total group. Likewise, in Numbers 9:14, there's a repetition on the Passover ordinance. I will not look at it, I don't think. But in Numbers 15, with regard to all the offerings and sacrifices in general, in Numbers 15, 15, and 16, at least as I understand it, I think this is consummative of the burnt offering and so forth. One ordinance shall be both is italicized, but you can read it with or without it. One ordinance for you of the congregation and for the stranger that sojourneth with you. And that again, see, is somebody who's coming into the community from a non-Hebraistic background. It is not pagans who live out in Babylon thousands of miles away. But anybody involved in the community circumstance, when it comes to to offerings and sacrifices, there will be one law. It will be the same. You won't look at the sojourner and say, well, your mother came from Philistia. You'll bring twice as much to the temple this week. There will be the same principle for both parties. And the same thing in Numbers 15:29 with regard to the accounting of the sins of ignorance. The soul sinning through ignorance, going back to the sin offering and the trespass offering in Leviticus 4 and 5. You'll have one law for him that sinneth through ignorance, him that is born among the children of Israel, and the stranger that sojourneth among them. So that's what we mean by a commonality of law or an equity under law. That everybody in the community that was thought of as being God's community had the civil right of equity and equal treatment under the law. Now, because men are fallible, they didn't get it then, and they still don't get it now. But that's a civil right, and that's an honest one. And in my own judgment, that can hardly be gainsaid, and it becomes a noble thing for believers to be concerned for, that there be the equal dealing with people under common bonds of law and responsibility. I wanted to mention a couple of the implicit concepts. I ought to give you a chance for questions. I will stop any time If you have a question, I'd like not to argue during the hour, but if you have a question, I will take it just about any time. Fall off your chair and collapse, you see, and I'll say, what's wrong? And you'll say, I have a question. But the problem is with all of us in this institute, we get rambling along at a great rate. But if you do have a particular question that you think should be dealt with at the time, if you will flag me down and state it, then I will repeat it for this tape so that we'll have it, and then I will babble for a little bit. And if anyone wishes to argue beyond that, why, I never did have a golden glove status, but I was pretty good at combat judo in the Korean War, so we can try it out if necessary at a later date. I wanted to mention a few of the implicit concepts under this civil right, the right of law. I hope you understand what that is. That's the right of law of everybody under a citizenship to expect equity and justice under a common law of responsibility. A few of the implicit concepts. The first of them is this general nature of the giving of the law, especially in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 5, and all the subsequent chapters of the law. There are no exceptional circumstances made on a class basis. I elaborate on that, I think, on page 3, or down at the bottom of page 2, in a little greater detail. But he never says, for example, you shall not steal, except so-and-so, if you're the majority party. You shall not steal unless you hold office in the public administration. The general concept of the law is binding at all classes on the level of responsibility to which it's addressed. Now, in case I'm not understood on that, see, as I said a moment ago, the priest, going from the altar to the tabernacle, washes his hands at the laver. Most of you common bumpkins never get to the laver. But if you were a priest, that's what you would do. You would take water from the laver of the foot and make sure that you were ceremonially, well, make sure that there was a cleanliness there that typified the ceremonial cleanliness and the heart cleanliness that ought to have been yours. So, but all priests went through that. Well, Simeonites and whatnot didn't. Simeonites would be outside the case. Let's say Asherites or Manassites or somewhat didn't. But all those of Levi who served in that particular function did. Likewise with a king. A king had certain responsibilities that other citizens didn't have. But all kings had those responsibilities. That's the particular point. So the general nature of the law looks out and says, no exceptions on a class basis, as I will mention under figure 4. The thrust of the teaching in two passages in Zechariah 7, 9 through 10, which tells what they hadn't done, and Zechariah 8, 16 through 17, which tells what they ought to do. They make interesting contrasts. He says in chapter 7, the Lord had told their fathers previously that they should execute true judgment, judgment marked by a standard of righteousness, should execute true judgment and show mercy and compassions every man to his brother, and oppress not the widow nor the fatherless, the stranger nor the poor, and let none of you imagine evil against his brother in his heart. That's the biblical ideal. The cultural pragmatism is pretty hard not to imagine evil against your brother in your heart once in a while. But of course, I'm not now speaking of a legalistic code, but of a practical concept in life. That's what the Lord had wanted them to do, and that isn't what they hadn't done it. But in chapter 8, it continues as the particular prescription for this time in verses 16 and 17. He doesn't want them to love any false oaths, doesn't want them to imagine evil against their neighbor, wants the execution of judgment. It is not word for word the same, but the thrust could hardly be mistaken. In other words, he says, I want you in the culture to make sure that there is a true expression of judgment to everybody round about you, that those who in life may otherwise seem oppressed are not oppressed by you, the poor and the widows. The Lord Jesus said, we will always have the poor with us. We always will. There is no excuse. I don't want to word excuse. Scratch that. There is no reason to think that there will ever be a time as long as men rule the earth in the present that we will not have the poor with us. There are some persons to whom you could give $5 million and before you'd know it, they would be poor. They would spend it on lollipops and Tootsie Rolls and other things like that. And it's one of the striking things that I know people who have very little money but are remarkably well off because they know how to cultivate it and use it. And I know others that make 5 times their income and are perpetually on death row. The wolf has been at their door so long that he has an impression of it on the end of his nose. So there will always be the poor with us. I am in favor of programs that help a man learn a skill so he can do better. Now, Leon Sullivan in Philadelphia, his theology may not be totally what you desire, but Leon Sullivan in Philadelphia, with the Opportunities Industrialization Center, has helped hundreds and hundreds of men and women to learn a trade which brought them into a better level of employment. Generally speaking, a plumber does much better than a fellow who paints white lines on parking lots at seminaries. You don't get anything for that, so that's a safe comparison. You just do that for the fun of it. But in a thing like that, he's helped many people, and I'm in favor of the sort of thing that helps a young man get an education, and helps somebody learn a skill or a trade that may improve himself. But you will find some lawyers that are poor, and you'll find some people that are enormously educated that are poor. Sometimes their poverty is caused by sin and wickedness. Sometimes it's caused just by stupid dumbness. I don't know if there's a difference there or not, but you will find that to be the case. And then you will find some who are poor because of the nature of the circumstance, the community, the culture, the background, countries where poverty is a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. There are some countries in the world that make every one of you look filthy rich by comparison on the simple standards of life. So the poor will be here, but they are not to be despised or taken advantage of by those who are not poor. That's what we call equality under the law. I will say something about that under another category in just a bit. Micah 6:8, I think I will not look at either. But that, you know, is where they're arguing with the Lord. Does he want him to do this, that, or the other thing? And the Lord says, all I want you to do is to do well and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. To do rightly or to do justly implies an equitable standard of conduct of living with all those to whom you have access and all those that are about you, to be equally fair with all. In the seminary, about once a year, I give an essay test to one each class. I usually give each class one. I give lots of tests, but on the whole, they are tests that can be graded without the inner turmoil of essay tests. So you have a question on the essay test. explain the difference. Explain the fundamental spiritual ideas in the burnt offering. Well, every student expresses himself in different words. You know you have to be terribly careful because some students, they're always good. They've always got A's. You always know that. Some students, well, he's always got an A. His answer could start out with saying, and at this point, Mickey Mouse got his umbrella out and walked down the street. You look out and say, well, he really knows. He really knows. Some other fellow could start out by quoting a paragraph from Bonar, and you'd say, that's phony. He doesn't really know. He's got to quote a book. In essay tests, it becomes awfully hard to be equitable because the mind of the teacher instinctively reads into the answers the quality that he associates with the pupil. Objective tests are about 30,000 times harder to make, but you don't have that trauma. It's either A circled or B circled. I get into trouble there, too, because I often say, if you really can't figure it out, write me a note on it. So I got a paper recently in which a student had circled five answers and written five notes on the back of it. And at the end of the fifth note, he said, whichever one seems right to you, I agree. Believe it or not, you can't mark an answer like that wrong. You just can't. They are not. Now, among the five, he's bound to have one right, see? But it's just that unhappy kind of a factor in the circumstances of life. Now, when I was in the service, I used to note it on men who would apply for passes, and I've been out of the Army a long time. In fact, I can hardly remember how we charged up that hill in Cuba. I've been out for a long time. But, I remember now. But, I used to watch men come in the orderly room to get passes to go to town on. For my first little period of duty, I did a lot of typing in the company orderly room, which will not interest you terribly, but that's why I was there. I didn't loaf there. I had a job typing. And the fellows would come in they'd come in hat in hand, for they have a 3-day pass. Well, under the military code in my day, everybody was entitled to one once every 3 months. Everybody was. But you could have two or three maybe at the discretion of the company commander. It all depended. There were some fellows who would walk in and the commander would say, go to town, yes, Smith, go to town. Have a good time, have a good time. Now come back Monday. Try to make it for Reveille Monday, Smith. There were other fellows that would come in and the commander would look and say, you've had two this year, haven't you? Usually his name was Walkowitz. He'd say, you've had two this year, haven't you? Yeah, well, you only get two a year. That's all we have to give you. Well, yeah. Save them up and take them in your next furlough. I can't tell you, unfortunately, if the company commander's name was Walkowitz, he usually got the pass and Smith didn't. It's one of those striking kind of things in which there is a great tendency not to deal justly with those round about us. Now, because we still live in this cultural move, we are often marked by pragmatism. We can't let it rule our theology, however. And that civil right of the right of law is something that every citizen who is not serving time or under some governmental instruction for his wickedness, you know what I mean, don't you? Arrest him. Yeah, in which every free citizen or every citizen in honorable is entitled to that concept of law. And that's been a big part of the problem behind some aspects of the movements in this country. Some aspects of the citizenry, it's not all a matter of race, although that's certainly entered in places. And that's not all in the Deep South. A lot of that was in places like Philadelphia and Snooktown and other places like that. So I'm not speaking now of a territorial classification, but a lot of persons had great difficulty getting that equality under law. Now, I wanted to make two or three observations along with that civil right. And the one is that the exceptions, there are exceptions to everything, almost. The exceptions are not class-oriented, but are individual in the places of their occurrence in loci, as, for example, somebody, you killed somebody accidentally. The law says thou shalt not kill. The law says thou shalt not kill. The law does not say thou shalt not kill, but if you back up your pickup truck and he doesn't get out of your way, it's all right. The law just simply says thou shalt not kill. Uses rahag, which we often translate murder. But it may also be translated kill in a couple of other passages. Murder is a better translation for it, however. You will not intentionally murder someone. You'll not kill him. But here's a circumstance where you do kill. Accidentally you kill. But it's still killing. The cities of refuge were set up that a man might flee to them. That's why when David cries for Abner, he said, did Abner die like a fool died? He should have gone to a city of refuge, and the thing could have been heard, and he would have been free from the vengeance of Joab. At least that's my understanding of that passage. But the cities of refuge were set up for that. It might not always be necessary, but it was the wise thing to do, because justice under the law was sometimes frightfully swift and mighty sudden. And so you've killed somebody unintentionally. But maybe his immediate peers did not realize it was unintentional. It looks to them like you planned it. Well, you ran to the city of refuge and waited for the appeal to be heard, or waited for the year of Jubilee, if indeed it was ever properly celebrated as the law called for. But whatever the case was, the city of refuge made an individualized exception for the person who killed. Now, there are also exceptions in the concept of those in military commands and those in various other aspects. I mention also the concept of Hezekiah's Passover. The cities of refuge are named by name in Numbers 35, I think. But the Hezekiah's Passover is an interesting one in 2 Chronicles 30. When, first of all, they celebrated it on the second month. That's okay. First month is normal, second month possible. They celebrated on the second month. But then there were a lot of people who, because of circumstances, had come to it without time to be ceremonially purified. And so they really were not quite ready. But they'd already delayed the Passover a month. And Hezekiah gave a moving prayer for them, I think. Verse 18 is the beginning of his prayer in 2 Chronicles 30. Gives a moving prayer. He says, the good Lord pardon everyone that's prepared his heart to seek God. So he hasn't had time for the ceremonial cleansing. But his heart is right. Now Hezekiah is not saying for a moment, look, if your heart's all right, it doesn't make any difference what you're doing. He's simply saying that as an individual exception in this circumstance, that here are some folks, it was completely out of their hands. They had no opportunity. They were strangers from the territory where the Assyrian king was mixing up the population. They had no opportunity. Lord, he says, you know their hearts. They've come to worship you. We would be foolish. Now, I'm interpreting here, but he's saying, in effect, we would be foolish to tell them, come back next year for the Passover. You haven't had time for the proper purification. So he prays a moving prayer, which I think is an honored prayer. He says, the Lord pardon everyone. There are bound to be exceptions in almost any kind of a circumstance. David ate the showbread. That's an interesting passage for further study too. But there are bound to be exceptions in almost every kind of a circumstance. And the individual who says, well, the application of the law is a rigidity that anybody who kills is always killed and so forth and so forth, misses the character of the law. The character of the law is a teaching and discipling kind of a thing. So I mentioned those things in particular. Exceptions to legal pronouncements are not class-oriented. You don't just look around and say, well, we accept everybody who's over 6 feet tall. That would be tough on me. I always wanted to be 6 feet. I attained my present height. Well, not really. I'm shrinking with age. But I attained maximum height when I was 14. I was 5'11 and a half. And that was key, having my hair flat. If you combed your hair up, I could make it. But at 5'11 and a half, never grew another smidgen beyond that. So somebody comes by and says, well, it's 6 feet, see? Everybody above 6 feet. You won't steal, except all the men over 6 feet. They can take what they want. It's a good thing that most of the big men in the world have passive and peaceful dispositions. Have you ever noticed that? The only times I've ever been punched voluntarily in my life was by somebody 6 inches shorter. That's happened several times. Fellows like John Grawley, who's a huge man, they always have passive and peaceful dispositions. It's nice the way creation works, incidentally. It speaks something for wise aspects. Elephants are docile. If the elephant attacked you like an ant, the whole world would be ruled by them long ago. You can see Adam, can't you? Oh, well. After the fall. Well, in a more serious vein, that's what we mean by exceptions. So they're exceptions to legal pronouncements. So here's a person who is absolutely starving to death, whether you want to read about him in De Maupassant or whatever that other Frenchman's name is. I'm never good in their names when I need them. But here's a fellow who's starving to death. He hasn't had anything to eat for months, and you've got 5 loaves of bread. And he doesn't take the common courtesy to knock on the door and ask for it. He just reaches up and gets it and eats it. Well, he's not supposed to steal. And I'm not saying he's right, but it's quite a different concept than the man who has a bakery business that comes by every morning and snatches it off your window just before you get ready to take it yourself. And in this case, there would have to be some judicial discernment as to whether the starvation was of that, you know, if it was that real or that magnitude. Half the people would tell me they're starving to death when I serve them dinner, don't want to eat it even. So makes you really wonder, I'm really starving. What are we having? Venison pot pie? With rutabagas and artichokes? That's about the way it happened, see? Mr. Weiss told me this morning when the people that ate breakfast saw that I was having cream beef on biscuits that they wouldn't want to eat, he says. During the regular year, he said, half the students get sick and go back to bed when they see it. Well, in the year they have that privilege, see, but in the institute you don't have that privilege. We don't let anybody get back to bed. So if you're going to stay up and be miserable anyway, you might as well be miserable on a full stomach as on an empty one, or something like that. Therefore, the exceptions are not class-oriented, but they are individual. Now, years ago, I was a student in a different place, and they had a circumstance there where if you belonged to a particular party, you could be registered to vote just... If you were of a particular class, a particular party, you had no trouble at all. But if you were not of that particular class, if you were of another class, you could have a PhD in biochemistry and maybe another one in literature, but not be deemed as being able to interpret the Constitution sufficiently to be registered. And in that particular community, that's changed, of course, but in that particular community, I couldn't help but feel at the time and feel it more keenly yet today that that's exactly the concept of what we call a class exception, which is not equality under the law. Ah, well. Particular groups, as I mentioned, may find more intense or varied laws. I mentioned the priest, the leprous person, for example. There are laws on leprosy that apply to all lepers. Now, if you're a rich leper, you know, you're filthy rich and suddenly you've got leprosy, you might be able, like the king, to dwell in your own house. Still shut off, still set out, still with a ban, but you might be dwelling in your own house. You're rich. You're still a leper. The leprosy laws pertain. If you think there's a healing, you still go to the priest and show yourself after the custom of Moses. If you're a poor leper, you may be driven out to the wilderness. But the general concept of isolation and the ban apply rich or poor, but they apply only to lepers. They don't apply to somebody with an acute case of acne. They apply only to lepers, see? But they apply to all of them uniformly, if the ideal nature of equality under the law is being observed. The same thing would be true of the prophet. The prophet could not make a false prediction. He could not give a prediction that was true and encourage you to follow a false god. There are a couple other things he couldn't do, too. But those things he couldn't do, and it didn't make any difference if he was the most famous prophet or if he was somebody that nobody ever heard of. The same laws related to all prophets. Do you understand what I'm saying there? Well, they were a class, see? You're not going to go out and make predictions. Hopefully. But the class of those who professed to have the word of God, they were not uneducated necessarily, but a class of those who professed to have the word of God, when a man stood up and said, I'm going to give you the word of God, certain conditions applied to him right away that did not necessarily apply to you when you were giving a recipe for hot cross buns to your neighbor. Wrong recipe. Recipe for, how about, I'm feeling humorous today, how about kid cooked in its mother's milk? Wrong recipe too. Two wrong recipes in a row. When you're giving a recipe for onion soup, a different principle applies. I hope you understand what I'm saying there. I don't mean to make it quite that complicated, but equality under the law, some people kind of think that means that everybody is equal in every aspect. Not so. The judge has a particular function to perform, and there are laws that cover judges that hardly touch the individual. I often execute weddings. I do it weepily. If you can get through a Taylor wedding without laughing and crying, it's a remarkable thing. Well, when the wedding is over, in the state of Pennsylvania, you have 10 days to get back the half of the certificate that the state needs. In New Jersey, you have 5 days. In Maryland, I think you have 3. That's a one of real fast in Maryland, New Jersey, 5. Pennsylvania, take your time. Utah, it doesn't make any difference, I think. But whatever the case is, they want to get it back fast in these other states. Want to move quickly on the particular procedure. Well, that's the law that applies to the minister. It doesn't have anything to do with the groom, but it applies to the minister, not just to one minister, but to all ministers who execute weddings and to all marrying people. The captain on a ship, the justice of the peace, the local judge, they all have 10 days to get that thing back to the court of ordinance court in the state of Pennsylvania. Now, the groom and the best man don't have to get sweated out. They can just go ahead and go down to the reception and get it over with. So that's what we mean in that particular nature. Now, the result is that there are still differences of station. Some men are more responsible, a pastor, a worker, an elder, a deacon. Some men are more responsible in greater degree and have specialized laws that cover their responsibility. Equality under the law does not mean that we all have the same job and the same place in life. What it does mean is that we all ought to be justly treated under the law as it applies on the broad base scale and then as it applies on the particular class scale. And that's a civil right. And in some parts of our country, it has been badly missed. In some parts of the world, it's a total joke. I realize that Solzhenitsyn's First Circle is a novel written against his own background. How many have read First Circle by Solzhenitsyn? Oh, good. A couple. You all ought to read it some, if you read that sort of thing. If you don't hold it against me. But if you read that sort of thing, you should get Solzhenitsyn's First Circle, which tracks out 3 days in a prison, high echelon prison camp in Russia. In which it's against his own background, of course, but novels are always prejudiced a bit by the writer. We understand that. But I can hardly tell you the feeling I thought. They were looking for a particular man who had done something wrong, and out of a possible dozen or so men, they had narrowed it to 2 men. And the investigator says, give me another 2 days, and I will tell you which one of the two it is. And the man in the account says to him, he says, don't worry. He said, if it's one of two, he said, we'll arrest them both and treat them both as criminals. He said, we'll know we have the right man, and there'll be no chance they get away. I can hardly tell you how I felt at that. Then I looked at it and said, well, it's a novel, but a novel reflecting conditions as he recognized them. I can hardly tell you how I felt at that kind of a disparity, see. So you can look at that and say civil rights are non-existent in a circumstance like that. Well, that's the concept of the civil right of law. I want to press ahead to the civil right of living. The civil right of living. That's the second civil right. Yes, sir. I mean by that, I might even be wrong in some aspects, but I mean by that that we have a man, for example, who's president of the biblical school, presumably. That's Dr. McRae. And then we have presumably a dean. That's Dunsweiler. His job, and we have a registrar, Mr. We really have him. You can see him in the flesh. One man has the duty of setting up an administrative schedule for the operation of the school. That's the dean. You do not have that right, nor that responsibility. Now, if you see that a particular student is not making a class because he's forgotten when it is, etc., you certainly have the responsibility to remind him and the right. But you do not have the responsibility to arbitrarily go out on the board and change the schedule. Although if you get Dr. Newman away from the 8 o'clock ones and me away from the 12 ones, we might defend you. But you don't really, that's what I mean. So that in a sense everybody's responsible for all in the common welfare, but not for the duties of special persons. If the average student went into the registrar's office and said, I want to make sure my record is right, we'd probably send his record to a nearby school. Maybe not, it's not that sharp. That's what I mean. The right of living, the civil right of living, is an interesting one. The explicit biblical concepts are a little bit less, and it's the weaker of the three. The third one is, again, a strong civil right, but it's one I've always been interested in. And that's the concept that since one is alive, he's entitled to a reception among men as being part of their group. He's living, and he has the civil right of being recognized as a living soul and as a living person. So that nobody has the right to look at you and say, you're nobody. I mean the moral right. And that's one of the things that we worry about in all of these right to life things. Mr. Clark touched a bit at it last night, I think. I am not an authority in those areas, but I can easily see euthanasia following abortion by about 20 years. I can easily see it. And I know there are some complicated issues on all this machinery and stuff. I don't understand that thing that's in the hands of technicians beyond me, but I can easily see a type of euthanasia which could be very easily automatic at 70. We just shoot you and it cuts down. You think Social Security's going bankrupt? Not after we get rid of everybody that's over 70. It'll be easy. I mean, that's far-fetched, but I can easily see it. I can easily see that if the value of living beings is not cherished, then you get a Hitlerian type of concept. You get it very, very easily. The value of human lives in the Hitlerian concept was warped beyond belief. I personally did not watch the Holocaust. I'm a man whose nerves and emotions are strained perpetually. I can hardly... I would have wept for a month. Some things are beyond me, and I'm wise enough to know that. And so I stay away from them. I don't watch soap operas either. But my children watched the Holocaust and came up and reported to me about every 20 minutes. And that was enough to keep me emotional. I'm just made that way emotionally, see. And we're all different in that line, but I personally didn't watch it. But I got reports. Every ad, I got a report. I thought it was good. I'm not big on television other than professional football games, which unfortunately are mostly on Sunday. But I thought my children should see it to get a grip on the way men are abusive to others. And they really got that and came up and reported on it fairly often in particular aspects of that particular thing. But the value of life was unbelievable. Now, years ago in New Jersey, what's the name of that? Magnolia. Years ago in Magnolia, New Jersey, I met a woman who had emigrated to this country from Germany in 1948. She'd married an American soldier and come to this country from Germany in 1948. And so I had an opportunity to know them through a church in Magnolia where I used to preach from time to time. Where she is today, I don't really know. But she told me that she was among her great-grandfather had been Jewish. And she, along with many others, had been arrested and sent to Auschwitz. And she said, I was in a long line of people, she said. She said, a long line of people. She said, I was wearing a medallion with a number and other things on it. And she said, we were passing a checkpoint, and people would look at the number and then look at the list. And she said, when I got to that checkpoint, she said, I stood there for a long time. She said, while this official looked down the list, and he said, your number is not here. And so she said, I was pulled out of that long line. She said, I never saw any of them again. She said, they were all killed. Well, they pulled her out of that line because they concluded that a great-grandfather who was Jewish did not sufficiently contaminate the Teutonic stock. One great-grandfather. But the thing that bothered me every time I think about it is what little stress was being placed on the value of life. And that's really a big thing. We worry, see, when somebody kills somebody. It's bad news. A friend of mine was beaten up in the city on his business. Two thugs knocked him to the ground and took his money, and the one hovered over him with a knife and said, "I'm going to kill him." And the other fellow said, "Don't kill him." And the other man said, "I'm going to kill him." They talked like that for 3 or 4 minutes on the street. And he said to me, he said, "I had perfect peace with God." He said, I couldn't move. He said, "I've been hit so hard." He said, "I couldn't move," but he said, "I could hear him talking." And he said, "In my heart, I had peace with God." And I said, "Lord, if they kill me, that's good. And if they don't," he said, So they didn't kill him, and he got up and finished his deliveries that day. But he said, when they hover over you, but the cheapness of life, when someone will hover over you and say, see, right then and there, a civil right has been lost, and that's the right of living. That life is somehow created by God, and that a person who possesses it has the right to be regarded as a living creature, a living person. Now, the explicit biblical concepts on that, I work hard in this passage in Luke 6, which is part of Luke's Sermon on the Mount allusions, Luke 6 starting in 27, finding its final point in verse 35, although the context goes on beyond that. In verse 35, the writer says, "Love your enemies, do good and lend, hoping for nothing again. Your reward will be great, and you shall be the children of the highest." This next phrase is the striking phrase. There are some textual things to be studied on it, but this is a striking phrase. "Children of the highest, for he is kind unto the unthankful and to the evil." Isn't that striking? He's kind to the unthankful and to the evil. Where does the reign of God fall? It falls on the just and the unjust. The sun shines on the fields of the atheists as well as on the fields of Bible believers. And when drought comes, it likely comes. So that God certainly hears our prayers and shows his grace in a wonderful way on his people. No argument there. But even to these unthankful blasphemers, every day there are aspects of the mercies of God that make their lives livable, whether they know it or not. I've often said in the seminary that the test of an atheist is when he swears. It comes when he swears. Although I don't urge you to go around asking atheists to swear, there's nothing edifying that. But I've had many people tell me that they had no use for God, didn't believe in God, didn't think there was a God. But when they got greatly irritated, they would call upon him to condemn you rather quickly. The real atheist is the man who, when he wants to curse you, uses the name of President Roosevelt or George Washington. May George Washington take your soul, see. And there aren't very many of those. But there are lots of adamant agnostics who say awful things about God. I don't really know where Ingersoll fitted in. Ingersoll professedly was a giant atheist. He's been gone a long time. This year I was using quotes from some of his lectures to make up tests in Old Testament history, in his lectures on the mistakes of Moses and other things like that. And from time to time, his unbelievably impious statements about the person of God and Christ were so severe that I just had to set it down and go drink a little coffee just thinking about it. I read a passage in The Lord of the Rings, which I meant to bring with me today, but I couldn't find my annotated version. I can almost quote it. Anybody read The Lord of the Rings? See, we have a lot of readers. Those things are not edifying to all. But in those things, Sam the Hobbit is arguing with Frodo the Hobbit in that long passage. And they are arguing about this scurrilous character who's trying to do them both in that he might get back the magic ring. And Sam says he ought to die. He says he ought to die. We ought to let him die. He says he ought to die. And Frodo the Hobbit says, "No doubt he ought to die," he said. And he said, "No doubt there are many who should die." And he said, "No doubt there are many who are dead who should have lived." Kind of a striking thing. So that the civil right of living is no mean thing. It's true that there are ways in which it can be lost. You can forfeit that right. But to simply become an arbitrary taker, that's not good. I used to play golf with one of my colleagues years ago. I've practically given that wicked game up. I never could score well anyway. But He used to have the habit of naming the golf balls after students. And he would take the golf ball out, and incidentally, he was pretty good. In my case, the golf ball is safer than anything on the course. He would take the golf ball out, and he would tee it up, and he would look at the golf ball. I just put a name in. I'll just use the word blank, blank. But whoever he happened to be irritated at, he'd look at the golf ball, and he'd say, there's old blank, blank. Look at him. Put it down. Then he'd pick up his golf club. He says, I'll show you, he said. Question my theology. I said to him one day, I said, isn't that committing murder in your heart? No, he says, just chasten him. He said, I don't want to kill him. He said, just hit him a couple times. Well, that still is chancy business with living. Now, this right of living, believe it or not, is what ought to make you a more careful automobile driver. Especially when you see a sign, children play. I tell you, a friend of mine in seminary hit a child in Philadelphia. He could not have helped it. It absolutely could not have been avoided. He was barely moving. There was a policeman right behind him in a patrol car who said he was not going more than 10 miles an hour through a crowded street. So there was no question of guilt or culpability. It took him about a year to get over it, though. But moving very slowly, suddenly a little boy ran right in front of him and stopped directly in front of the front wheel. He was killed immediately. The policeman was behind him. The boy's mother was beside him. It was a striking kind of thing. Now, he suffered from that for about a year, I would say. Feelings of guilt and other particular problems that he had taken a living life. But a few years ago, one of our friends in Hatboro was walking home from the big fair with her children along a main road. And they were walking properly, and she was holding a little girl by her hand when a drunk driver careened and struck the girl, tearing her from her mother's grip. He came from nowhere, so to speak, if I remember rightly, without even his lights on. He was intoxicated. He probably wouldn't even feel any remorse. That's the agony of that. And of course, there was a trial and many other things. But she, too, was killed instantly. When you drive your car, the civil right of living says, don't hazard somebody else's life. That's a big thing. And the same thing can be true in giving advice when you're counseling. If you're a pastor and you're counseling, you're giving advice, you know, you might really think that it'd be better if he did shoot himself, but it's not good to hand him a gun. A friend of mine used to say he might shoot you first anyway. But the right of living becomes that's a civil right. I mentioned the passage in Acts 17 explicitly. I'm not going to look at it, I think, where it talks about God having made us of one blood. God having made us of one blood and appointed these bonds. I wanted to talk a bit about the implicit concepts. I was going to read from the old Christian apologist, Athenagoras, but I think I may read a line. Although these fellows write like the Puritans. You know, the Puritan writers are those writers in the theological mold who found clever ways to take two words and make two chapters say the same thing. That's the Puritan writers. If it could be said in two words, it couldn't be good, so they expanded it. And these church fathers are kind of like that too. But here's a fellow writing in the early 2nd century A.D., arguing for the fact that Christians ought to be treated like other people. See, they were a true minority. He says, if indeed anyone can convict us of a crime, be it small or great, we do not ask to be excused from punishment, but are prepared to undergo the sharpest and most merciful inflictions. But if the accusation relates merely to our name, and it is undeniable that up to the present time the stories told about us rest on nothing better than the common, undiscriminating popular talk, nor has any Christian been convicted of crime, it will devolve you, illustrious and benevolent and most learned sovereign, to remove by law this despiteful treatment, so that as throughout the world both individuals and cities partake of your beneficence, we also may feel grateful to you, exulting that we are no longer the victims of false accusation. I will not read the next two paragraphs. They say about the same thing. But what he's saying is, we Christians are alive like everybody else. And we are, first of all, should be benefits of the civil right of law. But secondly, we should be benefits of the civil right of living, having the same character indulgence, assessment, and truth given us of all other people who receive the benefits of this particular empire. That's from Athenagoras, his plea for Christians. As far as I know, it's the only thing he's left to us for our study. I want to make a few observations on this right of living, just a couple of concepts. The fact that you are alive is an act of God's creative power, grace, and mercy. You may wish you weren't born from time to time. You may wonder that you weren't here. But the fact that you are here is an evidence of the creative power of God. And the civil right of living is the very same right which ought to move against things like suicide and genocide and all of those other class forms of extinction in which the value of life means so little. I have found in the Old Testament two general things that work with observations on it. One was the sabbatical year, and two was the Jubilee year. I don't know that it can be proved that Israel ever observed a Jubilee. Pretty hard to prove they ever observed a sabbatical. But there's some discussion at least on that. But the man who became poor and couldn't care for himself and had to take out the redemption laws and whatnot for the Jubilee concept of Leviticus 25 and whatnot, in the 50th year his property came back to his family. His home is good so that there'd be a fresh start there. He could not be disenfranchised as long as he was living, and his heirs as long as they were living. The sabbatical law is slightly different, but applying to slaves and whatnot, says essentially the same thing, that there is a civil right of living in which the person who lives and draws a breath ought to be regarded as a living soul and treated accordingly. The next time, I say it to myself and I say it to you too, but the next time you feel like looking at somebody and saying, well, he is absolutely worthless, he shouldn't even be alive, think twice on that. There are crimes that call for a forfeiture of life. Life in itself is not the supreme thing. But think twice before you suddenly conclude that somebody is totally worthless and shouldn't be around anymore. I want to mention a third civil right, the right of society. The right to belong to society and the right to be treated by that society after patterns governed in God's ideal concept. Civil rights, the right of law to be treated equally, the right of living to be regarded as a human being, and the right of society. The right of belonging to a social level and having within that certain social rights that the society ought to perform for you. I will mention later that I object to the concept that the world owes me a living. That big, you know, that lazy man's concept, that blind man bluff form of socialized thinking. But society does, if it follows the pattern of God, owe us some things. And the things that it owes us become the societal right, or the right of society. Whether Jefferson had those in mind with the Declaration of Independence or not might be hard to prove. But society does owe us some things, and we as a social group owe some things too. The explicit concepts that I mentioned first are in Leviticus 19, which, friends, is one of the great chapters in the Old Testament, forms the background for 1 Peter 1 and probably for a lot of 1 Peter 2. Leviticus 19. I shan't read the whole chapter, but I've given a number of verse references in this page. It demonstrates to us that if you're a holy person, you demonstrate it not by going off and living in a monastery, but by living in a world of people and showing that Christ is alive in you. Holy persons are not necessarily people who live in caves all the time by themselves. You might live there and have wicked thoughts all the time. You might hate your parents. You might hate the cave. It's hard to tell. I'm not a hermit type myself. I can take a little solitude. The next solitude I get will be the first in some time. But I'm not asking for tons of it. But holiness is proved in living with other persons. A friend of mine was watching a program in which notably wicked people pointed out how if they'd been converted, their lives were totally changed, and there was nothing at all wicked, bad, evil, or weak about them anymore. And he said that hasn't been my experience. He says, I wonder if I'm really a Christian or not. And you have to be careful how you say these things. I'd like not to be misunderstood. But I said to him, before you really can know whether they've changed that much or not, you'd have to be around them for a little while. I heard a fellow preach a great sermon on worrying one time. In the pulpit, you can sound like a combination of John Bunyan, George Fox, Calvin, and Luther all at once. He preached a great sermon on the sin of worrying. It was powerful. And since I am one of the last of the true worriers, it was very convicting. I wondered if I would survive. I wondered if the death angel would meet me at the door. I'm not joking. I didn't really wonder that. It was a powerful sermon. Delivered with great force, dozens of Bible verses hammered out at us. Well, as is often the case, I stood there talking with many people, and the service was over, several hundred people there, so there were a lot of us that felt bad that night. But I stood there talking with people. The first thing you know, there were only five or six people, and the speaker came back with the host pastor and shook hands with him. And I didn't know whether to say good message or what, so I just shook his hand and mumbled a little bit and let him interpret as he would. But then we went outside, and he discovered there was a flat tire on his automobile. I suddenly saw that it is very easy to preach about worrying, but it is hard not to worry. While a couple of the brothers changed his tire, he paced back and forth, wondering how it had happened. Had somebody done it on purpose? Had somebody let the air out? Would he get home? Would the others blow out? See, even there I have a bad attitude. Right away, it's hard to... You don't correct one bad attitude with another bad attitude, but I was glad to find that all of the great worriers had not been converted by that sermon. Holiness is proved in association with people. If somebody comes up and says, I live in total sinless perfection, you may have a ringer on your hand since you've been with them for a little while. A game of golf would be a good way to test it, or almost anything else in that line. But Leviticus 19 emphasizes the right of society. Note what some of those things are as I've tried to sketch them under the explicit concept. The right of the aged to be respected. The commandment, honor your father and your mother. It does not stop when you're 25 or 30. You don't live with them anymore, and you don't have to go and get advice for them. You don't have to go and ask them for nickels to go to the candy store. That's a long time ago, too, incidentally. But the right of them to be respected by you as a child is a lifelong right. Because as long as they're here, you'll still be a child. Your father can be 103 and you can be 82. That doesn't mean that you have to go and say, Dad, can I go out tonight? But it does imply that in verse 33, you'll honor the hoary head. Not the hairy head, the hoary head. You'll honor the man whose hair is white with the frost. And that is a societal right that the aged should be respected. Now, what if they are nasty and rebellious and impossible to live with? Well, respect them as persons. You can respect the most grumpy and cantankerous thing alive as a person. Doesn't mean you have to cajol to them on everything they do or necessarily pamper them in every detail. But to respect them as a person, and that's sometimes hard to learn, but that's an important thing. You will have the right to it if the Lord doesn't wind this thing up. When you get older, you don't run out in the young world and say, respect me, I'm old. But if one begins in the present generation by respecting those that have gone before him in a biblical pattern, they have the right to it. And he kind of prepares himself for an investment in it also. Did I say it already? It doesn't mean that you go and say, can I go out tonight to your father who's 103? It doesn't mean that everything an old-timer says is right, but it means you respect him as a person advanced and moved on in the course of age. I was reading an article by a Greek father last year in connection with some work I was doing. One of these pious Greek monastic persons of about 1720. He was giving the men on Cyprus a lecture about beards. You'll find it very timely, fellows. A good many of you won't have anything to worry about, and some of you should start worrying immediately. He said, for a mature, an older man, not to have a beard, he said, is a wicked sin. He said, he's trying to look young. You get that? He said, the older mountains have snow on the top of them. He obviously had not been to my geology class. He said, they have snow. So he said, as a man gets older, he said, he should begin to grow a beard. And when he's old, he said, it should flow and look like the snow in winter, he said. Mark of wisdom for a young man to grow a beard, he says, is trying to pretend that he's old in advance. And he said, that is equally bad. So he thought the young should shave them off and the old should grow them on. I don't know what he would have said about fellows like me that have just four whiskers and you could put a ribbon on each one and let it hang separately. I don't know what he would have said about fellows like myself. But that was kind of the way it went. The right of the aged. Note the right of the poor in verses 9 and 10. Note the right of the poor. When you go out to your fields, you don't take every grain. You leave some for the poor and the stranger. The right of the poor. They said it's the right of the poor to help. It's not the right of the poor to go and rob the field. But it is the right of the poor to glean after you and to sustain himself. And the same thing is emphasized in verse 33 to some degree. The right of everybody to be told the truth. You'll not give false oaths against your neighbor. The right in verse 13 that people have to a just due, not to be defrauded, not to have their wages held back, not to be cheated. That's a societal right that is owed to you under a biblical ideal, and which in turn you owe to others. The right of the disadvantaged to have proper courtesy. Verse 14, you'll not curse the deaf nor put a stumbling block before the blind. You'll not make fun of those who are disadvantaged in life. The world is a cruel place, and you'll often see somebody who's spastic and all the kids in school will make fun of them, especially if it's a cruel circumstance. But the writer says you won't put a stumbling block. Why would you put a stumbling block in front of the blind? To laugh at him when he falls. That's why. That's a first-class Teutonic sense of humor, incidentally. But to laugh at him when he falls. And why do you curse the deaf? Because when you say it, he can't hear you. So you yell louder. About the third time you yell, you pronounce the bane of God on it. And there are a lot of other disadvantaged people besides the deaf and the lame. There was a fellow in a conference where we were a couple of years ago. I have five children, and some of them at times have made me happy, and sometimes have not made me so happy. But there was an insolent guy at a conference I was at several years ago. He was 18 or 19, I suppose, who double-talked a great deal. Some of my students have heard his story 30 times. He double-talked a great deal. You know, double-talking means you can't understand it. The words come out in some circles. He would have been very popular right away for the manifestation of certain traits. But he double-talked. And after he'd go through a long sentence that nobody could understand, he'd end it with two words that you could understand. Sugar, please. Or something like that, see. And he particularly preyed on those that didn't hear well and those who were older or those who looked like they weren't paying attention. He was particularly fond of going into the snack shop where some older brother would be quaffing a malted milk and babbling at this double talk. And after about three times, he'd say, "Don't you hear anything I say, Gramps?" he'd say. Well, he was too old to spank, I suppose, and not big enough to kick. But just an insolent person. Not worthless, but insolent. One of my daughters was standing there drinking a super big Coca-Cola that she had conned her father from the money out of in a big plastic cup full of ice. She's often not made me proud, but on this particular day I could have given her a star. She's a vacant-looking blondish type who often just stares in the distance. This fellow walked up to her and blurted out something and ended with the word cola. And she looked at him and she said, "What?" He smiled and he bumbled a long phrase again of this double talk that nobody could understand and ended it with the word Coke. Before he could snap his fingers, she reached out and grabbed his T-shirt. She pulled it out like this and she threw that Coke right away. It was so electrifyingly fast. And of course, there was a thunderous roar of applause all at once. He stood there looking terrified with his clothes filled with his ice, see? If I could have given her, of course, one prize for 400 demerits is not much, but if I could have given her a prize, I would have given it to her right then for that particular quick action. Of course, when he was gone, whiningly, she asked for more money for another Coke. I could hardly turn that one down, I think. I mean, she actually got about a Coke and two-thirds out or something like that. But you see, some people will take every possible disadvantage of those that are, but not under the societal right. If you're disadvantaged, you have the right to be fairly and honorably treated. And consequently, you have the responsibility to show that. I mention also the concept of the poor to justice. Same standards for the poor as for the rich. Matthew 5:12 is the famous golden rule. Mr. Kaufman may have touched on it yesterday, but I was downstairs trying to print. But the golden rule, whatsoever you'd have others do to you, that's what you ought to do to them. Not like some people say, you do it to them before they do it to you, or you do to them what they've done to you. But that's the right of society. The right to be treated as you would want to be treated. And in Luke 10, the Good Samaritan is a classic example. After this fellow says the Lord to justify himself, "Who's my neighbor?" The Lord tells him his long account of the Good Samaritan and says, "You go and do likewise." And of course, you're familiar with the general analogy of it. The Samaritan was the last person in the world who should have felt any obligation. But he felt it on a societal basis. He could not pass him by. He was a member of society. And consequently, he takes his donkey and takes him to the inn, and he says, I'll pay his bills for him. Ironic that the priest and the Levite didn't care, but the man had a societal right to be cared for, and society had a right to provide for him. Now, as I said a moment ago, you can't stand back and say, I'm old, you've got to respect me. I'm blind, you've got to help me. But those are rights that ought to be expected, and they ought to be shown first so that nobody has to demand them. That's the big thing. That's the big thing. I spent a weekend at Keswick, or 6 days, I guess, with a man who was born blind. He was the pianist and singer, and I was the preacher. And it's hard to know, he was blind with his eyes, and I'm often blind with my head. But we had a great time being together. I noticed he turned on the lights when he went into the room every night. Turned them on. When he went to bed, he went over and turned them off. When he left in the morning, he felt the switch and made sure it was off. When he shaved, he turned on the light over the mirror, turned it off, and it was done. He'd been born blind. You could not see his eyes due to that particular formation. I said, Walter? Got to know him well, see? I said, Walter, I said, I notice you always turn the things off and on. I said, why is that? Isn't that what the sighted people do, he said? I said, yeah, that's what the sighted people do. He said, when I was a boy in the school for the blind, he said, the man said, Walter, he said, the world belongs to the sighted. He said, they don't need you, but he said, you need them. He said, don't do anything to make them distrust you, dislike you, or not want you around. He says, I found a lot of sighted people that don't want us around. But that's not the way it should be. We ought to extend the right, see, to those that are disadvantaged in life. And, of course, if the right of society is extended, it puts down a lot of rebellion. Marie Antoinette should have thought about that when she was baking the cake. And if the right is extended first, it quells a lot of rebellion and difficulty before it comes. Society, I'll bypass my implicit concepts. The one in Malachi 2 is a tricky one. I probably shouldn't have even put it down. Where he's pleading, do we not all have one father? It's a complicated interpretation. The Timotheian concept of servants and masters in 1 Timothy 6 will speak for itself, I think. But the observation is that society should not regard any of its members as being intrinsically inferior. Different skills, different abilities, and different callings, but not intrinsically inferior. As soon as it begins doing that, then it can talk about eliminating a certain number of them. And likewise, the debts owed society by the member should be observed. You can't stand back and say, the world owes me a living. There was a sense in which Kennedy was right. You really should say, what can I do for my country? We're not bypassing that for a moment. You look and say, what can I do for my church? There are things that we ought to do as individuals for church, country, and society, but there are certain things that society as a group ought to be thinking of for its members too. And those are the societal civil rights. If they're not honored, you'll find social abuse, you'll find revolution, class revolution. It's usually followed by totalitarianism or anarchy and things far worse than what existed beforehand. Now, the thing that I plead for with the sanctity of life and civil rights is that those who are believers in this age should learn to respect that which ought to be accorded to others, regardless of race or background, or even, if you please, their crazy religious notions. I say that pejoratively, as Mr. Tunfeiler would say. We ought to learn to value that concept of right, of equality under law, right of living, right of social practice, which are properly a part of the civil population under the theocracy of the Old Testament and under the planned theocracy of the millennial age. And certainly those things that were true of God and his dealings with people in those ages, you'd hardly look around and say, well, we shouldn't be concerned with them in the church. We certainly should be concerned in those things that are consistent with God. I don't know how those things are always prosecuted in the practice of life, but I will say that if you can stand by and watch somebody make fun of the deaf, if you can watch somebody stumble the blind, if you can watch somebody kill others because they're of a different class, then somehow one is missing the whole concept of civil rights and promoting a sort of disorder. There ought to be a sense in which we are more properly concerned that which a citizen ought to have under the law and ought to have as a member of the living, and ought to have as participant in society, there ought to be a sense in which we're concerned to see that he has it. And if more were concerned, there would be a lot less strife and grief and difficulties.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. We minister to people through our graduate and postgraduate degree programs, our community evening school, our cassette ministry, special seminars, and a free publication, Biblical Bulletin, containing interesting articles by biblical faculty members. For a free cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.